Let us pray. Our Father in heaven, thank you that we're warm and dry on a cold, wet day. Thank you for the amazing things that you have done in history to make things so good for us today as to purity and liberty and in practice of religion. I pray that you'll help us to learn about it and that we'll be inspired in ways about it to be able to be faithful to you in our times. In the name of Jesus, amen. All right, the old quiz. Question number one. For how many years in a row did King Charles I rule without calling Parliament? Of course, he ruled without calling Parliament for short times, several times. That one long time. How many years was that? Question number two. What was the name of that document signed by many of the Scots at Greyfriars in 1638 in response to Bishop Laud trying to impose a new prayer book on the Kirk? What is the name of that document signed by many of the Scots first at Greyfriars in 1638 in response to Bishop Laud trying to impose a new prayer book on the Kirk? Number three. Was it the express intention of Parliament when it convened in November 1640 to carry out a revolution? Was it the express intention of Parliament when it convened in November 1640 to carry out a revolution? Number four. What is the name of the king's chief servant who was impeached by Parliament and eventually executed in 1640? Now, you might have noticed his proper name, or you might have got the name of his title. Either one will suffice in answering the question. If you want to give yourself a mental bonus point, you could give it all. Number five, did the Root and Branch Bill become law? Did the Root and Branch Bill become law? Okay, number one, how many years?
11.
The name of the Scottish document?
The National Covenant.
The National Covenant. The Solemn League and Covenant is later. Was it their express intention to have a revolution?
No.
No. What was the name of that chief servant of the king impeached and executed in 1640?
Scafford.
What was that?
Strafford.
His name was Thomas Wentworth, Earl of Strafford. I noticed that on the first page of the reading assignment, that name Strafford was given about six or seven times. So I didn't feel bad in asking for that.
I said it to myself several times.
Did the Root and Branch petition, did the Root and Branch Bill become law?
No.
It barely passed the
House of Commons.
Did not pass the House of Lords and then was dropped. I will now let's see. I will now put a number of fingers, 1 through 4, on my hand under the table where you can't see it. No. I will. How can we make this to be at random? Okay. I will put some number 0 through 10 on my fingers under the table. And then I will ask each of you to add or subtract, whatever you please, some single digit of numbers to what I have started with. And when we have done it, whoever's birth month our number is closest to has to say the whole thing. Okay, so Angie, you have to add or subtract to what I have under my on my fingers. You have to add or subtract some number 0 through 5.
Subtract 2.
Okay, I have done it. Alvin, what do you want to do?
Add 4.
Okay, I have added 4. What do you want to do?
Subtract 1.
I subtracted 1, and what do you want to do?
Subtract 5.
And it is 0. The resulting thing was 0. So your birth month is February, the second month. So you get to say the whole thing. You're also the oldest, so that's fitting.
Okay.
If Angie makes any error whatsoever, the person whose birth month is next closest has to take up from there.
Okay. 1509, King Henry VIII ascends the throne of England. 1526, Tyndale's complete New Testament in English is printed. 1534, the Act of Supremacy officially separates the Church of England from the Pope. 1547, King Edward VI ascends the throne. 1553, Queen Mary I ascends the throne. 1558, Queen Elizabeth I ascends the throne. 1588, Spanish Armada is defeated.
Hold the phone right there. It's not that you said anything wrong. It's just that you skipped one. So right after 1558, Queen Elizabeth I ascends the throne. So the number was 0. Second month was the closest. Both of you have the happy birthday in the same month. So then since yours is slightly before, you have to start from there. Next one after 1558.
1560, Geneva Bible is published. 1588, Spanish Armada is defeated. 1603, King James I ascends the throne. 1604, in the Hampton Court Conference, King James agrees to a new Bible translation. 1611, authorized for King James Version is published. 1625, King Charles I ascends the throne. 1628, the Petition of Right is passed.
Congratulations. Angie, we can say congratulations to you too because you did not actually get any of them wrong. You just left one for Audrey. Okay. Thank you, friends. We got two new ones for today. 1640, the Long Parliament convenes. 1642, the English Civil War begins. 1640, the Long Parliament convenes. 1642, the English Civil War begins. And the reading assignment is the next chapter in your book called The Great Civil War. You know, there were numerous other civil wars in England and Scotland and Ireland over the centuries. They typically get called by some other name. It's this war that gets called the Civil War in England. Romans chapter 13, if you please. Romans chapter 13, would you all please read aloud verses 1 through 7. Well, how about this? Angie and Audrey already did their share of the work. So, Alvin, you read us verses 1 through 4, and Ava, you read us verses 5 through 7.
Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is God's minister, an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil.
Therefore, you must be subject, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience's sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for they are God's ministers, attending continually to this very thing. Render, therefore, to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor.
Amen. So we're reading now, starting to study now about civil war. And in civil war, something is going on to where submitting oneself to the powers that be, it ends up being unclear who that is and to whom your allegiance belongs. It happens when there is some situation where there's some severe corruption of government and different parties claim to be the proper government. So then Christians have to figure out, okay, well, if I'm going to submit myself to the powers that be that are God's minister, who is that? We're going to have our lesson today from the beginning of the Long Parliament, actually a little bit before that to explain the beginning of the Long Parliament, until the outbreak of the Civil War or Civil Wars. You sometimes see it in the plural because there was more than one when it happened, or you sometimes see it in the singular as if it's just one with interludes. So backing up just a little bit from the start of the Long Parliament to kind of make sure we understand the start of it. Remember that we learned about the king by Archbishop William Laud trying to impose a new prayer book on the churches in Scotland. Well, they wouldn't accept it, and so the king and the bishops tried to impose it by force. 1639, the First Bishops' War. But the poorly funded English army did not succeed even in invading Scotland, much less conquering and putting down the rebellion and imposing the prayer book. The army was not a professional army. It wasn't well armed or armored, not well supplied and organized. It was basically made up of those men who could be got cheap or pressed into service, and they did not succeed. So, 1640, the king called for a parliament. He had to have money. He had to have revenue, had to have taxes that would be imposed, that would be passed by parliament, that he then lawfully could collect. Now, he's not that concerned about them being lawful, just it being possible actually to collect them. If they're passed by parliament, then the country will pay them. He's been having trouble raising enough revenue without that, as you know. This was called in April 1640. It was called to fund the campaign against Scotland to impose Laud's religious measures. Problem was, the parliament, at least the House of Commons, didn't want that done, right? So a debate was scheduled for May 7th, and it was probably going to end up with a resolution not to approve of the invasion, much less provide funding for it. So, since that was to be done May 7th, the king dissolved the parliament May 5th. Thus, it is called the Short Parliament. So, over the centuries, there are other parliaments that end up being referred to as the Short or the Long Parliament. In the context of the 1600s, this is the Short Parliament. So, that summer, in the campaigning season, you know, Northern Europe, summer is the nice weather. You know, we don't want to go out and do anything in the middle of summer here, but there, you know, the army campaigning is done in high summer. And so there was a second Bishop's War conducted August to October 1640. The again poorly funded English army was defeated. It was so badly defeated by the very good Scottish army that the Scottish army actually invaded and occupied part of the north of England. A truce was signed, leaving the Scots in control of a good part of the north of England, including, very importantly, Newcastle. I don't know how English and Scottish people say Newcastle. I doubt they say Newcastle. However they say it, it was the main center for providing coal to the rest of the country, especially to the city of London. So the Scottish found themselves in control of London's source of coal, left them in a very strong bargaining position. So those things are before the Long Parliament, but necessary to understand the situation that the occasion for the calling of the Long Parliament, what things were like. Now, from here, from this point, almost everything I'm going to say is close to word for word from Dr. Keith Wrightson's Yale lectures that I've watched on the internet 100 times. I don't want to blame, I shouldn't have said word for word, I don't want to blame him for the stuff that I say, but the substance of what I'm going to say is very closely taken from his lectures. The Long Parliament was called for, elected, and convened November 1640. Of course, it wasn't referred to as the Long Parliament at the time. It ended up being many years long. Dr. Wrightson said there was a very large turnout of voters. Estimates are that about a third of the men of England voted. When the House of Commons convened, John Pym, P-Y-M, became the main leader. Parliament found itself in a very strong position relative to the king. The king was in desperate need of funding since the Scottish army was actually in possession of part of England and the important coal center of Newcastle. Of course, all the king wanted was vote revenue, right? Vote taxes that I can then collect, but that's not at all where they started. They started with serious accusations against Thomas Wentworth, Earl of Stafford. Earl of Stratford. He had been the king's main servant, his right-hand man. And a lot of the arbitrary government not by constitution or law or custom, but just by whatever the will was of the king and his officer at the time, a lot of it was actually advised by Thomas Wentworth, Earl of Stratford, and then actually executed by him. So that whereas the king is responsible, being the king, Thomas Wentworth, Earl of Stratford, was actually the person who did a lot of it. not immediately, but soon, William Laud, Archbishop of Canterbury, was imprisoned in the Tower of London. So those two main offenders in the imposition of an arbitrary government or a despotism, both of them, Parliament began to deal with. Just over into the new year, by our reckoning, but remember back then, the first month of the year was March. So in January 1641, by our reckoning, but still 1640 to them, Parliament passed, and the king was pressured and forced to sign the Triennial Act. So establishing that by law, Parliament would convene whenever the king called for them, or once every third year, even if he didn't call for them.
How do you spell it?
Triennial. I don't know by what trick of Latin or English the A in annual becomes the E in triennial. So January 1641, by our reckoning, the Triennial Act. As you can tell from what we've already known, extremely important development in government. If you are indicating how much power does the king have in England's government, how much power does Parliament have? If Parliament now will convene every third year, whether he calls for them or not, the power of the king has gone down tremendously. The power of Parliament has gone up tremendously. That same year, 1641, or in the next year by their reckoning, May 1641, Parliament passed a bill and the king signed it, saying that Parliament could not be dissolved without its own consent. So those have been the two main problems, right? That the king wouldn't call for Parliament for years, and then when he did call for Parliament, if it didn't please him, he would dissolve it. So the Parliament has the king over a barrel here. The king really, really needs them to pass taxes to fund his army, and so Parliament is passing things. The king, of course, doesn't want to sign into law, but he's under such pressure, he has to agree to those things. Now, during that period, during the spring of 1641, Thomas Wentworth, Earl of Strafford, was tried in the House of Lords. The way impeachment worked back then, and it still is the same way in our government, modeled after it, is that the lower house, the House of Commons, more directly representative of the people, may impeach a government officer, which means formally to accuse him of high crimes and misdemeanors. But then the upper house, in their case the House of Lords, in the case of our federal government, the upper house is the
Senate.
The Senate then conducts the trial, serves as a jury for the trial. That's how impeachment works in our federal government. The formal accusation, the impeachment, is made in the House of Representatives. Then the trial, to determine guilt or innocence of those charges, is conducted in the Senate. Now, the way impeachment has always gone, the few times it has taken place in our United States federal government, it has gone like this. In the House of Representatives, the president is only impeached if the other party is in power. And so the impeachment is more or less a political move. Then he is only convicted in the Senate if the Senate is also the other party. So far, the way that's gone in our government is that the impeachment has never resulted in conviction in the Senate in the short history of our republic. So he was tried in the House of Lords and found guilty. And the bill of attainder was issued, so that then in May of 1641, the king had to sign Strafford's death warrant on the basis of his being found guilty in the House of Lords. Thomas Wentworth, Earl of Strafford, had been the king's, one of the king's very closest allies and chief officers for years. The king, under the political pressure, had to do Parliament's bidding, signed his death warrant, and Strafford was executed. Archbishop Laud was also executed. Well, now, I'm not as sure as I thought I was that that's so. We'll have to wait on that. I think that's so, but I don't want to state that without being more sure than I am at the moment. So then, coming into the summer of 1640, let me pause there for a second, May of 1641. By May of 1641, Parliament has succeeded in making tremendous gains in their power to curb the king's exertion of power. If now Parliament has to come, even if he doesn't call for them, if now Parliament can't be dissolved by him, if now his officers that he appoints, Parliament can try and convict and have executed, well then, of course, Parliament's power relative to his has gone way up. Now, summer of 1641, Parliament passed laws abolishing those courts that the king was using to convict people who were trying to resist his things like imposition of ship money and forced loans and things like that. The Star Chamber and other prerogative courts were abolished by act of Parliament. The king was pressured and signed it. The ship money and other taxes that were not by act of Parliament were declared illegal. And then, having accomplished all of that, Parliament recessed. It was still Parliament, but they were on break. While they were in recess, King Charles I traveled up to Scotland, and he withdrew his previous demands regarding the kirk, or the churches. By William Laud, Archbishop, he had ordered the new prayer book and some other things. He now rescinded that. In a deal for the Scots to withdraw their army out of England, which they did. So, a lot happened really fast there. And so that in less than a year, during the Long Parliament, a number of wrongs had been righted. The out-of-control power of the king had been reined in. The imposition of religious corruption by Archbishop Laud was ended. Crisis with the Scots was averted. I'll now add something. This is my own thought here. I didn't hear this from somebody else. It seems to me that it's very tragic that a great opportunity was missed right there. It seems to me that at that point, Parliament and the people they represented, their position was okay. I'm certain it was not perfect, but the main grievances they had accomplished redress of those grievances. Not by the king's goodwill, but by pressuring him. The king, for his part, it seems probably it wasn't going, not too much more had to happen after that for Parliament to go ahead and approve the taxes that would fund his army and be able, they could, it seems to me that right there, a new normal could have been achieved that could have been satisfactory to all parties. That was not done, and horrible civil war ensued. But I'd like you all to just at least have a moment to think about that. Political compromises have been done to set things into a way that basically was okay for everybody. I don't know if anybody loved the situation at that point, but really, everybody could have been okay with that. And there is, you know, there's no wisdom in doing something wicked to try to appease wicked people. But there's all kinds of wisdom in being willing to accept a situation that is okay when it's been terrible and now it's okay. There's some wisdom there in people saying, okay, in this sinful world, we're not going to have anything perfect. This right here is okay. Let's maybe think if this is a good place to stop. But events overtook them, and they were not able to settle in right there. November of 1641, so the Long Parliament has been in session for a year. November of 1641, Parliament reconvened after their recess. And news was arriving in London from Ireland. Ireland wasn't very far away, but there was no telegraph yet, and so it still took some time for news to travel that far. News came in of serious rebellion in Ireland. In Ireland, the people generally were Roman Catholic. The Protestant Reformation had got almost nowhere among the Irish. The population of Ireland was mostly people who had been, you know, Irish as long as anybody could remember. There were also people who were referred to as the Old English, and they were basically of Norman ancestry, people who had come and taken property in Ireland during the conquest by the Normans. Now that, if we're talking about events of 1641, that's a long time ago, you know, 500 years ago and more. And so those people were almost all Roman Catholic. But there also had been imposed in northeast Ireland, in Ulster, there had a Protestant minority had been given land in that area. Some of them were Scottish, some of them were English, but they were Protestant, and they were a very small minority, but they were a very powerful small minority. Well, the Scottish rebellion, having gone so well over the last couple of years, the Irish formed a confederation, including those old English and those native Irish, all Roman Catholic. They had a plan, they had a confederation, and some of the nobility among them led a revolt against the Protestants in northeast Ireland. However, the plan, the revolt did not stay within the plan. But there was lots of killing. There was slaughtering of Protestants in northeast Ireland. by the Roman Catholic Irish. Dr. Wrightson said it is sure to have been at least 4,000 people killed. Some of the reports being given in London were that it was way more than that. But it was very significant numbers were killed in this rebellion in Northeast Ireland. So in London, it was known something has to be done about this. The natural thing to do would be for the Parliament to fund a big heavy-duty army for the king to use to go put down rebellion in Northeast Ireland. However, Parliament is not at all sure they can trust the king with a big, well-funded army because they're concerned he might not only use it against the Irish rebels, but against them. So, the solution that John Pym sought was to try to institute more restrictions on the king's exercise of power, then grant the funding for the army. So John Pym introduced the Grand Remonstrance. The Grand Remonstrance. A remonstrance is, in effect, an objection, kind of a complaint, but more than just complaining, objecting. And, you know, we have another important remonstrance a few decades earlier, the Arminian Remonstrance in the Netherlands. The Grand Remonstrance here in Parliament, introduced by John Pym, listing many complaints about Charles's rule from the beginning until up to that point. Those many complaints that were listed to justify Parliament's demand that in the future, all of the king's officers that he appoints have to be approved of by Parliament. It's okay with us if you approve your buddy, if you appoint your buddy to be commander of the army, but he's only to be commander of the army if Parliament also approves of him. And that has found its way into our system of government, where a lot, not all, but a lot of the government officials that the president appoints only take office if approved of by the Senate. Now, he also had in the Grand Remonstrance insistence that Parliament may have an assembly of ministers to reform the Church of England. The Church of England was still episcopal in government, the king at the top, appointing the archbishops, appointing the bishops, on down from there. It was an episcopal form of government. There was a very widespread, very well-established belief by that time among the Puritans that that was not a biblical model for church government. Now, up until that time, Parliament was, and much of the country, was almost unanimous in their opposition to the things the king had been doing. And you can see that in that the Parliament, both houses, passed these several things I've just been talking about. And the king had to sign them because there was such a unified opposition to the king and his people, what they'd been doing. But this right here, the Grand Remonstrance, especially including the provision that the Puritans would get to have an assembly of their ministers who would then decide what the church was going to be like, the Church of England was going to be like after that. That split the Parliament, not split between the House of Commons and the House of Lords, just split even within the House of Commons. and split the opinion in the whole country. That grand remonstrance passed only 151 to 148 in the House of Commons, and then never passed the House of Lords. Pym had the grand remonstrance published and distributed through the country. Yes, miss?
151 to 150 or
140? 151 to 148. You know, the teeniest little, a very teeny little difference. Barely a majority. Dr. Wrightson said it in these words: this gave the king his party. Up until then, the king had very few supporters in this conflict. He was very broadly seen as in the wrong, especially his officers, Earl of Strafford and Archbishop Laud. But at this, the country, in effect, split in two. The parliament split in two. Up until this point, it could be said very credibly, the king is trying to overthrow our ancient constitutional form of government. And then if the king and his people said, no, the parliament is trying to overthrow our constitutional form of government, that didn't get any traction, because it seemed evident to the whole country, generally, that parliament was only trying to restore the old constitutional government, where the king would only collect the taxes parliament funded, and the king would only rule according to the laws parliament passed. But at this point, where it was proposed by the leader of the House of Commons, and it was passed in the House of Commons, that the Puritan ministers were going to have free rein to restructure the church. The Church of England was a huge institution that involved, it affected everybody. Then that gave the king and it gave the king's position credibility in people's minds in England. No, look, they are trying to overthrow the ancient constitutions of this country. The king gave that response to the grand remonstrance. There's no way he would approve of it. It would be an overthrowing of the country's constitutional government, because in their whole thing, the church is not separate from the government. They're distinct, but they're not separate. And the idea that the Church of England, which as long as it's existed has had an episcopal form of government, now is going to be changed by the Puritans, that was an accusation then that people found credible. And so the country and the government, you know, were at that point then split roughly evenly. That vote in the House of Commons, 151 to 148, more or less represents accurately the situation in the country. So December 1641, the king rejected the grand remonstrance. Now, in January, and we would call it 1642, but they would still consider it 1641. January 1642. January 4th. The king was considering going in person to the House of Commons and arresting John Pym and other leaders of Parliament. When he hesitated to do it, his wife, Queen Henrietta Maria, insulted him, calling him a coward, goaded him to go ahead and do it. And that's not a legend or anything. Her words are known to history. The fact that she did that is public knowledge. And so he went with hundreds of soldiers. He went to the Houses of Parliament, and not the soldiers, but he himself, entered the House of Commons. I read that it was the first time in history the king had ever entered the House of Commons. He went in and demanded the five members, but that this was going to happen had already become known, and they were gone. And there was some sort of witty banter about the birds having flown the coop. The Speaker of the House of Commons expressed the concept to the king that he, in his office as Speaker, could only do the will of the House of Commons, not the will of the king. Now, that move was, in effect, a declaration of war between the king and the people, or the king and the parliament. It was not actually a declaration of war. I'm telling you, it had that effect. The king had never come and entered the Houses of Parliament to arrest the members before, but now he had. Shortly afterward, the king left London, and the king's family left London. The queen left England to go to France. The parliament was still in London, and London's the capital. So there came to be the situation where part of the government was in the capital, and part of the government had left the capital. The king, you know, everybody recognizes, is, you know, rightfully the ruler of the country. But if the king actually leaves the capital, then there is some question, is he abdicating rule over the country? He has been accused of governing in violation of the country's constitution. Now he has entered the House of Parliament to try to arrest members, never done before. That seems to be a very unconstitutional thing to do. And now his next thing is to leave the capital. And so there's a lot of fuel for the position that the king is in effect leaving off governing the country as king. That wasn't his position, of course, or that of his supporters. March 1642. Parliament started passing ordinances and considering them binding without the king's approval. In effect, Parliament started ruling the country without the king. Parliament passed a militia ordinance to raise troops and appoint officers without the king. Not raising them for the king, but raising troops and appointing officers itself. There was no open warfare yet, however. June of 1642, Parliament offered basically one more deal to the king. Parliament offered to king 19 propositions. That's the name that document has come to be known by to history, the 19 propositions. And some of them are just the same provisions from the Grand Remonstrance. He was supposed to agree that all important officers of his, he could appoint them, but they had to be approved by Parliament to take office. And they proposed that he should assent to whatever church reforms the Parliament decided on and advised him. Now, I realize here is where it's in my notes that the king replied that would be a subversion of the excellent constitution of the country. I think that I told you that's what he replied to the Grand Remonstrance. And I think I need to take that back. I don't know what he replied to the Grand Remonstrance. He rejected it, but I don't know what he said. It was to this. It was to the 19 propositions that he replied that if he agreed to that, it would be a subversion of the Constitution. July 1642, Parliament voted to raise an army. Not an army for the king to control, an army for them to control. Parliament voted to raise an army. And the actual deadly violence of the Civil War started that month, July 1642. At various places around the country, the king's men were going to some of the towns to take control of their armory or their magazine containing gunpowder, lead, and whatever else, to take control of their arms. At some of the towns, the people of the town allowed that. It was done. Some of the towns, it wasn't. In the town of Manchester, the people of the town resisted, and in the initial struggle, one man from Manchester was killed. And that is, apparently, that's at least referred to as the first person to die in the English Civil Wars of this time. Many people had died in English Civil Wars before that. The first person to die in this Civil War at Manchester in July 1642. In August 1642, the king raised his banner in the city of Nottingham. It's always fun for us to hear about Nottingham since it figures prominently in all the movie versions of Robin Hood. And he called on all true subjects of the crown to rally to him and support his cause. The king raised his banner in the city of Nottingham. Now, whereas in July of 1642, that was that initial struggle at Manchester in which one person was killed, August into the first day of October, the royalist forces laid siege to the town of Manchester. But in a series of battles, small-scale battles, the royalists were successfully held off and driven away by the local militia. During that violence, about 200 royalists and only about 20 militia were killed. Finally, a truce was called, prisoners were exchanged, and the royalist forces withdrew. And here's something I find very interesting. There was then no further violence in the town of Manchester for the duration of the whole Civil War. Well, I think we should pause and and take a lesson there. When those in authority, the king or whoever the highest authority involved is, gives lawful orders, then the people are to submit to those lawful orders. That's the first, most important line in God's will for us regarding how to deal with the government. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers. It says the same thing somewhere in Peter's letter, I think in 1 Peter. Be subject to the... And then, as our Declaration of Independence says, people have realized it's not smart to refuse to submit to the king at the first little problem. It's better to just be patient and wait and suffer things as long as you can. But when it becomes obvious that the higher powers have actually become the main violators of your rights rather than those securing them, then it's time to maintain the principle of submitting to higher powers, but consider who the lawful higher powers really are. We had this in, and then this often comes to a head right at the point where those who are supposedly the lawful government want to seize the people's arms. And remember how many times we've already learned about this. Not that they predate this, but remember we learned this in our studies of American history, because the British Army and Navy, and they were at loggerheads with the American colonists, but there wasn't actually yet open warfare until General Gage takes the Marines and heads down the road to seize the magazine at the town of Concord, right, and met some resistance from the Americans previous to getting there at the small town of Lexington. So Lexington and Concord, April 1775, the actual warfare started when the military of the king was going to seize the people's magazine. So then we have also had Texas history together just last year. There was trouble between Santa Anna's government and the people of Texas. But when did the war really, really begin? It began at the town of Gonzales, when Santa Anna ordered whoever to come and take the cannon. Meanwhile, over at the fort where this cannon was going to be taken, there were so many cannons they couldn't even mount them all. So it was obvious that the only reason to take the cannon... Yeah, so that's when the war actually began. Well, both of those events are later in history than what we are reading here. When were the first shots of the Civil War actually fired? Or when did the first person actually die? When did the war begin in earnest? It's when the king's men come to take the town's arms. Now, I don't know how well the American colonists knew this history. Pretty well, I would think. Don't know exactly how well the Texians at Gonzales knew these previous parts of history, but at least as of knowing the American history, they probably knew it pretty well. I know that the principal of this school was sitting in class sometime last year and asking, you know, when does the war really start? You know, is it at the killing? Is it at the bloodshed? And we're saying, yeah, I think so, but that usually coincides with the government that you supposedly are supposed to submit to is coming to steal your arms away. That's when the actual war for independence, Revolutionary War, Civil War actually begins. So we could date the beginning of the English Civil Wars to January, when the king came to the House of Commons with soldiers, but it's normally dated to August 1642, the king putting up his banner at Nottingham and the Siege of Manchester. Now, this principle of religion being imposed by force, and the people at that point saying, no, we're not going to have your official religion imposed by force. And the principle of the government coming supposedly in the name of lawful government, that is God's minister, coming to steal away your weapons. And people saying, no, this is at the point at which we say no, and we say no with with closing the gates and shooting our guns if necessary. An extremely important point to etch into your conscience. All right, that's all we have time for, friends.